All right, so I'm John, and I'm teaching this, and with Francis Barchi. Francis is in Botswana for the next 3 weeks. For the first 3 weeks, you've got me, and then she'll return. We'll both be here for most of the courses, the classes. I think I'll miss one, and the last night of class is going to be the August or late July, August 1st or something like that. Or July 31st, but the last week we're not going to meet because Francis and I are both out of town. But anyway, so this is the purpose of this class really is to focus on vulnerable subjects, and it presumes that you have some kind of background in human subjects research. The program wouldn't allow us to kind of create or require my research ethics class as a prerequisite. So what we're going to do is spend the first 2 or 3 weeks kind of like rushing through human subjects, rushing through the history, rushing through the U.S. regulations. And in part of that, to kind of bring everybody up to speed somewhat, we want people to do in the first 2 weeks to do what the online CITI training. So CITI is the Cooperative IRB Training Initiative out of the University of Miami. On Blackboard, there is a set of instructions on how to access CITI. If you've already done it, you don't have to redo it. Just send us your certificate, right? And other than that, it takes a couple of hours to kind of go through. I think you have to kind of go through the readings and do the tests, and then they issue you a certificate. And it's pretty cold, and the good thing about it is that if you open two windows, I'll give you the hint. You open two windows and you go through the text, and you can open the test window over here, and you can go through the test that way. But it's really the idea here is to kind of bring you up to speed as quickly as possible on what the U.S. regulations require, and it's not to be particularly arrogant about the U.S. regulations, except they do have a lot of imprimatur around the world. A lot of developing world countries don't have their own regulations and the like, so they look to the U.S. regulations. And it turns out that later regulations, especially SIAMs, draws heavily on the same protections that the U.S. regulations do, just in different ways, and then expands upon them in some ways that we'll talk about a lot in this class. And so you have to do the CITI training in the first 2 weeks. The course grading is based on evaluations. We want you to basically do cases and do 2 to 3 page write-ups of an analysis of the cases. And we'll give you a framework before we dig into that too deeply. We'll give you a framework for how to analyze cases. It turns out that there are regulations and guidelines available to us, and we want you to know what those guidelines are. And so don't give us off the top of your head what you think is ethical or not ethical. Talk about what the rules are and how the rules speak to what the issues are that you see, right? And this will be the skill set that we want you to come out with in the course. So, and it'll emerge in the next couple of weeks. What else? So you have to do those. Class participation is a large portion of this. It's a seminar, participatory seminar. We expect you to do the cases, come prepared to talk about them, right? And let's see. Everybody should have access to Blackboard. The cases you'll upload onto Blackboard. I'm not sure, Francis and I are still kind of working out whether or not you have access to others' commentary and the discussion forums on the Blackboard. This is just for emergency purposes. But it's also so we can access them and grade them. And if it turns out, if you want to discuss things online, we might be able to kind of structure something like that, because that give and take can be pretty valuable, can be pretty time consuming. But the good thing is you can do it at your own leisure. Thank you. All right. Any questions about any of this? You should also, in the beginning, so when you get on Blackboard, has anybody been on the Blackboard site yet? Yeah, anybody not? So get on there and take a look at it. And there's Francis created something called the Ethics Sandbox. There's two things that are actually unique to this. I mean, one is that all the readings in the syllabus, you have to kind of look at the syllabus to kind of see what you're supposed to read and what cases you're supposed to do each week. All of the readings are basically under course documents. All the readings are just kind of alphabetically listed, right? In one, it says course readings, and there they all are. So it's not broken up by week or anything like that. And then the cases, I think the cases are the same thing under a separate directory. So the syllabus becomes the way to kind of walk through the required readings and the timeline. But then there's the ethics sandbox. The sandbox has the common rule in it. I believe it has the Belmont report in it, which we'll talk about. Both of those things. It has SIOMS. It has Declaration of Helsinki. It probably has the Nuremberg Code in it as well. So it has these core base documents that you really should that you should know. I mean, in some ways, download those first and become familiar with what they are. And ultimately, I mean, use them when you're going through the cases, and we expect you to kind of like know what the different sections are and what they're talking about and the commentary, especially in SIOMS, has fairly dense commentary to the guidelines themselves. So, and when you're thinking about international research, those are the guidelines that you really kind of called on to do. All right. So, can we go around and maybe say a little bit about what your research is? So, I mean, I'll start. And so, I'm John. I'm a lawyer. I have a PhD in public policy. I've been doing research ethics stuff for the last 15 or so years, or more than that. And I've been teaching this, not this course, but my research ethics course, which a number of you have taken since 1997. And I really like the subject matter, and hope that comes through. And I do human subjects research. I do survey research, qualitative research as well, and other stuff. So, yes, sir?
My name's Ralph. I'm a basic science researcher at Abramson. I'm looking at different nutritional compounds, especially flaxseed, and its role in lung cancer. I'm currently applying to the Masters of Public Health program, and I just want to gain some more exposure to the field of bioethics.
Okay. Sorry about the phone. My name's Richard. I'm a medical student. I'm actually in between my second and third year at Mayo Clinic. I'm coming out here to do the master's program. I'm interested in psychiatry, and I've done a little bit of human subjects research in that, but in the first 2 years of medical school, and hope to continue that and get some more background in bioethics. So.
Hi, I'm Blair. I'm a nurse. I work over in the pediatric ICU at CHOP. I am getting my master's in nursing and in bioethics, so I don't have any specific research experience, but we do research all the time with the kids in my unit, so I'm just interested in kind of getting a background.
Talk about vulnerable population.
Yeah. Okay.
I work at Penn as a research assistant, and
What's your name?
I'm Caitlin. I'm sorry. And I do research on engineering human T cells for adaptive immune therapies. I'm looking to transition more into the humanities, so I'm hoping to go back for a PhD, possibly in medical anthropology. So I expect to be working with human subjects in the future.
Good.
I'm Anson. I'm a fellow in developmental and behavioral pediatrics at the Children's Hospital. I'm doing a master's program in bioethics, and my fellowship research is looking at behavioral health screening in primary care, really kind of addressing for underserved communities.
I'm Renata Yusek. I'm a physician in Tanzania, and I'm here as a full-time PhD student. Also, I'm a pediatrician as well, so I think I'm really happy to know these people in the pediatrician.
I'm Katrina Burns. I'm a graduate of the BBE program, and I'm in the grad school of education, getting a master's in media and literacy. I'm interested in teaching research ethics to K-12, and I'm also interested in health disparities.
I'm Ed Connor. I'm a pediatrician. I'm on the faculty at Children's Hospital in D.C., where I run an office of innovation development, and my background is in pediatric infectious diseases. I've been doing antiviral research and vaccine research for a long time now.
Welcome back.
Yeah.
I'm Ken Clothen. I'm a lawyer, just finishing the MBE program this summer. My thesis work involves implementing a program in teaching research ethics in Guatemala to the two medical schools there. John is the head of the team. Then writing an editorial about, actually not then writing it, I guess writing it before, on the evaluation or lack of evaluation of teaching of medical ethics.
My name is Jackie Wise. I'm a clinical research coordinator in the School of Medicine at Penn. We're looking at MRSA in the hospital and sepsis in the ICU. And I just found out I was accepted to the MBE program.
Congratulations.
I'm Shelley Bierenbaum. I'm a lawyer in Canada. I do health law, and I am also finishing up my MBE, and I sat on an IRB for a number of years, but I've never studied it systematically, so it's a good opportunity.
I'm Mir Masood Alias. I'm a lawyer as well. I am in the process of applying to the MBE program. I work for Penn's Office of Research Services on these research collaborations between the university and industry sponsors in various kinds of clinical trials and other studies. This subject matter is of personal interest to me. I grew up in a developing country and where a number of trials I understand are run today, so I would like to know more about sort of the research ethics involved in that.
My name is Baraka Morris. I'm from Tanzania. I'm here with Renata. Actually, we are in a fellowship. When we go back, we'll be teaching bioethics in Mbeu University. It's one of the medical universities in our country. By professional, I'm a nurse. Registered nurse.
Did you ever do any research? Were you ever involved in any?
Yeah. During my studies, it's one of the requirement that you have to do a research in that. Okay, I did a research, it was dealing with human subject. I was looking on the single parenting, the consequences and the prevalence of single parenting in our country.
I'm Ben, I'm an MBE student and I work at Penn's IRB and I have no research background and I'm taking this course to get a, you know, to get that research background. Populations.
Christine, I also work at the IRB, and this is my first semester taking the bioethics classes. I hope to probably apply, and I obviously enjoy this subject. I do have a research background. I previously worked on a research project at Virginia Commonwealth University before I got into the IRB.
Were you there when they were shut down?
No, before my time. But I was actually, I'm a participant of the subject, or of the study that got them shut down.
Seriously?
The twin study, yeah.
The twin study?
Yeah. They never did anything bad to me, so.
What do you think of the questions they were asking? So this is a sidebar. Sorry.
I didn't have a problem with it. They're, now that I'm older, it's like a lot of standard, you know, psychological measures.
But they asked
like
about parents and stuff.
Oh, yeah, they interviewed our parents also. Mm. Yeah.
Hi, Justin. We'll talk about that.
Yeah.
We're going around introducing ourselves.
Great.
You missed everybody.
But there's
we
time.
Know who you are.
Yeah. Go ahead. Oh, hi, I'm Robin Parcell. Sorry I was late. This is my second semester with the program. What am I supposed to say?
Research experience.
I've done a little
or
bit
what
of
you, where you want.
Okay, so my background's actually in biology, biochemistry, and gerontology. I've done some work in public health, but I'm currently at the Institute of Medicine of the National Academies of Science, dealing with issues around health science policy and ethics. So, hi.
Okay. So, obviously, we all have a very wide set of backgrounds, and that's one of the reasons I think that this, as a participatory seminar, this really works. I mean, everybody kind of brings their own unique perspectives and backgrounds. So don't be afraid of jumping in. As this goes on, we'll try. I think Francis is better at this than I am. We'll try to kind of like draw and call on people and get people involved who aren't kind of volunteering, but you know, just try to wade in whenever you think it's appropriate. all right, so tonight, as I said, the beginning of this class, if you look at the syllabus, the idea here is in the first 3 weeks is to kind of run you through. So the first week, tonight I'm just going to talk about the history, how we got the rules that we have. For those who have taken my research ethics class, this is repetitive. Not that you can leave, it's probably worthwhile. Just because it's a lot of material. And then the next week, you've got assigned the Belmont Report, which we'll talk about. I'll talk about what it is, as well as the common rule, or in the 45 CFR Part 46, which is the set of rules that guide U.S. research, in a paper by some guy named Zeke Emanuel. But that's next week we'll talk about the code in detail. All right, so this is the core set of rules that kind of guide research for people here, right? And the next week we wade into the international stuff. So we'll wind up reading the Declaration of Helsinki, the SIAM's guidelines, and the ICH guidelines, which are pretty repetitive, right? And that's where we'll also get into how to do a case analysis. Right. So, without further ado, unless anybody has any questions, and again, please interrupt at any time. We'll just do that. Let's wade into the history, shall we?
Back on the address now.
I had one yesterday. This is the two today, so tomorrow it's no more.
All right. So this set of slides actually has a lot of stuff on informed consent. Wasn't my intent to go through informed consent tonight unless people really want to do it. I'm trying to think, it might be the only time that we really have to do it. It just turns it into a long talk, but I think let's wade into it and see how far we go. All right. So, in these things, you've seen this wellness report. All right. So, the main message to take home here is that ethics and law has been highly reactive one of what I would call seminal events in research ethics. This is not limited to this field, obviously. I mean, kind of in signal events happen in lots of the fields that kind of precipitate public policy reactions. This is no exception. Hi. You want to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Lee Taggart. I work actually for the School of Nursing.
Okay.
Just
about
my third class.
Oh, okay. Good. There's a sign-up list for phone numbers. And so what we're starting with, the syllabus is online now, just to kind of bring you up to speed. And tonight we're just kind of reviewing the history and how we got to where we are with rules. All right. So there's lots of cases that are, and these things are, there's definitely more cases than the ones that I talk about, but all of these had some sort of reaction. The earliest that I can really talk about is in 1898, a guy named Al Neisser was conducting research on pretty much prostitutes and infecting them with syphilis and gonorrhea. He has known, anybody know, in fact, anybody know who he is, Neisser? Nobody does ID work. Albert Neisser discovered gonorrhea.
His name is the gonorrhea.
Yeah, it's the test for gonorrhea, right? Yeah. But he discovered the gonorrhea bacteriums, whatever it is. And this became public, leading to Prussian regulations, basically prohibiting research on children and other vulnerable populations, requiring informed consent. We're also another case that was happening around this case. I mean, the interesting thing around the turn of the century was is that this idea that consent could save you. It's like where does that really come from? And we're not really sure because there is an idea, of course, in common law that you couldn't really touch someone without their permission. And I think consent is really predicated upon that, and especially if it's research. It's like, well, shoot, we're not going to do something. You're not going to expose people to risks, especially when it's not for their benefit, without getting their consent. So around the same time with yellow fever experiments by our military, who's the military guy that did the yellow fever experiments? Anybody know?
Walter Reed.
Walter Reed, right. So Walter Reed in the early turn of the century was running experiments and trying to figure out what the genesis of yellow fever was. They suspected that it was mosquitoes. So instead of doing a natural experiment like spraying and wiping out mosquitoes and wiping out mosquito nests, and all, you can really take out nests, but wiping out mosquitoes, they basically enrolled people and paid them lots of money to be bitten by a mosquito. One of the researchers, a guy named Monday night, Tuesday night. Lazier succumbed. He wound up actually getting yellow fever and dying from it. He was a fairly young guy. And the interesting thing about that story is that even at the turn of the century, they lied about, they said basically he'd been exposed. They didn't admit that he'd been bitten in the experiment because if they did, they felt that his life insurance wouldn't have paid out and he had a wife and kids, two kids back in the States. so they lied. Anyway, there was a consent form. If anybody goes to the University of Virginia website, there's the library there has a fairly thorough kind of description of the experiments, including the consent form that they used, which told people they could get yellow fever and that they could die. And one other person, I believe a nurse, did get yellow fever. They paid people, I believe it was $200 in gold coin, which at the turn of the century was a heck of a lot of money. And if you died, then your relatives got the money, got the coins. Anyway, so let's see, another thing that happened in the turn of the century was a concern about, and this is just kind of the reaction to bad events. There was a lot of concern about muckraking, about selling, pawning off fake goods in interstate commerce and the like, and it led to the 1906 what was called then the Pure Food and Drug Act. And it created the Food and Drug Administration and gave them authority for regulating interstate commerce, regulating the labeling of foods and drugs. Right? Before that, it was just kind of a free-for-all. And anyway, this becomes important later. In 1930, in Germany, there was the Lübeck BCG TB vaccine tragedy. Right? Now, this is basically a tragedy. The vaccine was contaminated. It was released into the marketplace, and I believe 190 children, give or take, wound up dying, right, because of the contamination in the vaccine. And the government responded by enacting regulations, regulating research as well as innovative practice, medical practices, which is always a challenge. I mean, how do you distinguish something that's innovative versus actually something that's being studied? Innovation doesn't, just because something is innovative and experimental doesn't mean that what you're doing with it is research. Right? You know, different things. Anyway, this happened. It was interesting, and one of the things that you sometimes see in this is a kind of a disjunction between the policy response, and we'll see this again, disjunction between the policy response and the problem that's identified by the case that precipitates the policy response. Right? And in this case, you know, it wasn't really research, it was a bad product that was put out in the marketplace. You'd think that the correct policy response would have been quality control of vaccines before they're released, and that's not really what happened. All right. 1938, back on this side of the pond, we had the elixir of sulfanilamide case. So, sulfanilamide, anybody know what that is? Sulfanilamide is it's a antibacterial? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was an early anti-infective, essentially, and for treatment of fevers and infections. And the Massengill Company, which owned this drug, decided to put it into, it was a powder that adults could basically take, and they wanted to put it into solution, so they sent it down to, they got a chemist in the bowels of Massengill who put it into solution in an elixir, it was an ethylene diglycol, which is one molecule off, apparently, from antifreeze that we use in our cars. Right? And data from 1920s, late the mid-1920s, showed that this stuff was highly nephrotoxic, right? Meaning it would kill someone's kidneys if you ingested it. The chemist didn't know about that data, and they wound up putting it into solution. The only testing that they did was they cherry or strawberry flavored it and made sure that it tasted okay, bottled it, and shipped it out to the marketplace. Within a week or two, there were reports coming back in to the feds that there was something going on. I think about 106 children died from exposure to this. And apparently the model was that if you gave it to your kid, and your kid was sick, you gave this elixir to the kid, and the kid gets sicker, you give them more, they're going to die. And if you didn't, if you said, well, this isn't working, and you stopped, the child might survive. So the FDA started looking into it, and they had no real jurisdiction, except under the Truthful Labeling Act of 1906, because an elixir uses alcohol as a diluent, right? And this was not alcohol-based. Therefore, they had the authority to pull this off the marketplace. And it became pretty apparent that there was no prior regulation of the risks and benefits, and whether or not nobody was looking at whether or not the stuff actually worked and kind of did the things that people were labeling it as doing, and whether or not it was safe. So this led to the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1938. Congress's response, which was probably the right response, was a regulation of safety, basically said that any, before any drug is released into interstate commerce, that it has to be tested by various means for safety. All right, moving ahead into the 30s, into the 40s, the Nazis were busy over in Germany. In 1948, the first post-war criminal trials were of the Nazi doctors. There were 23 doctors who were put in the dock who were charged with war crimes, crimes against humanity. As part of this, they did have, of course, they had a statute here, these regulations, there wasn't a statute, it was regulations that they could have said that, well, you didn't get consent and you didn't do all these other things. They didn't look to those regulations. And they didn't look to a kind of international law of torture and mayhem either. But what they did is they got two U.S. doctors, particularly Andrew Ivey, to tell them what the law should be, tell them what the rules for doing human subjects research should be. And as a result of that, as part of the final decision of the court, part of the final decision was what's become known as the Nuremberg Code. And from a fairness perspective, it was kind of weird because you're basically saying, here's the law, you're guilty of it. Whereas the law didn't really exist before the tribunal decided the case. Right? From a due process perspective, you'd like to know what's illegal before you're shot, before you commit the act. Right? But and so the whole thing is a little bit weird for that reason. Anyway, this code, because it was issued by this court, arguably this code and this court was essentially U.S. lawyers and judges, the U.S. judges, and it was issued in a formal military hearings, that has some precedential value. Nonetheless, no one has really ever followed it. I mean, the status of it is somewhat up in the air. It was made more complex because of two reasons. One was that in 1948, the Department of the Army, which had jurisdiction over this, realized that they had to comply. There was a memo that was written, and John Moreno kind of dug this up some years ago. There was a memo written that said, you know, here's the Nuremberg Code, we have to comply with this because it was issued, you know, by an army tribunal. And that memo was stamped top secret. So everything kind of like it became kind of like you couldn't know, and it was really unknown what the scope of this thing was, even though it was stamped top secret. But the code itself had been published in JAMA in 1947 after the decision was handed down. So people knew about the code, but the army's self-imposed kind of like requirement that we're going to comply with this was not really that widely disseminated. That became important because in the post-war period, we were doing all kinds of crazy experiments. The CIA, which we'll talk about, the CIA was doing experiments. The army was doing experiments, all in support of the war effort. And it's really questionable whether or not they were complying with the code. In fact, they were definitely not complying with the code. It was also important because while the code was published in 1947, it was very easy because of the circumstances under which the code was promulgated, these crazy doctors doing these crazy things to these people, that the organized medicine could basically say, that's not us. You know, we don't act like that. We don't kill people. We don't denervate their legs, and we don't, you know, chop them apart, and we don't freeze them and thaw them out and purposefully infect them with yellow fever. It wasn't yellow fever. We do that. one of the other virus-borne diseases. Anyway, so doctors were very able to kind of distance themselves from the code. Yeah.
What is the status of the code today? How is it considered legally in terms of?
I don't know. I mean, nobody wants to really. I mean, there are some people out there who argue that it has the force of law. It's a constitutional issue here in the States. And others kind of ignore it. I mean, and it's practical as a statement. If you look at it, it says, you know, the first principle is that the consent, the informed consent of the subject is absolutely essential. Nobody would take that literally. Right? The thing that says, well, before you do anything that has any risk of harm in it, that the investigator should do it themselves first. I mean, maybe that's a good idea, but you know, its practical effect is somewhat limited. So, nobody, I don't know, it'd be interesting actually to look at the lawsuits that have been filed against IRBs and kind of for violation of research ethics and see if they've actually invoked the code. I just don't know.
The Army must have rescinded it then. It's top secret memo.
That's a good question. Did they ever kind of say that they don't have to comply with it? Because the Army has its own IRBs, and the IRBs comply with the Common Rule. The Army is one of the signatories, that's why it's called the Common Rule. And they signed on. Maybe by signing on to the Common Rule, replaced the older set of rules. All right. So, rolling ahead, in 1954, came to light there was some social scientists from the University of Chicago, without the knowledge of the jurors, but with court permission, surreptitiously taped 6 criminal court juries in Wichita. And they went, of course, and they went forth and they published their studies and like, and they had court permission. But when it hit the press, a year later, the public was actually pretty outraged by this. And it was this violation of the sanctity of the juror room, which is actually, in some ways, it's pretty ironic because you can walk out of the jury room and talk your head off as a juror. There's no prescriptions on jurors talking at all. In fact, just look at the OJ and how many books written by jurors or informed by jurors or interviews with jurors after the OJ trial, right? But nonetheless, this idea that you can't go into this and tape. And some 30 states passed laws in the period after this prohibiting this kind of thing, right, this kind of behavior. Okay, moving ahead, 1962, it was the thalidomide case. Anybody heard of thalidomide? I got some clinicians around the table. Yeah, what's it used for nowadays? Anything?
Is it used?
What's being done with it? Yeah. Cancer, I think. Yeah, is it used for, or is it just being experimented?
It's still being used, I don't know what its actual
official status is. Thalidomide is actually a wonder drug. It has some really, really good salutary effects, but it's also highly teratogenic. Teratogenic means monster-causing, right? In this case, it caused thacamelia, which is little flower appendages on newborns. And crazily, this drug was originally sold for morning sickness, so it was given to the women, exact populations you wouldn't want to give this kind of thing to. So here was a kind of undiscovered risk. It was suspected. It was actually never put on the market in the United States. There was an analyst in the bowels of the FDA who was looking at data and just didn't trust this product. It was being marketed in Europe. There were cases in the United States because some women had gone to Europe and gotten the drug over in Europe and brought it back here. So when I was a little kid, I remember seeing, very rarely, but I would see some children with this condition. In Europe, it was a much bigger problem. So the drug was kept off the market here. But it turned out, after the kind of realization of what was causing it, there was a large public outcry. Everybody went to Congress, and Congress responded with an amendment to the FFTCA. That amendment required the proof of efficacy. Right? So it kind of modified the first one. Remember, in 1938, the problem was risk. Right? Let's look at this and have people assess the risk. Here, it was kind of an undiscovered risk of fetal development, and our response, the policy response, was required that you prove that your drug works, right? Which is kind of unrelated. The correct policy response, or at least a limited policy response, would have been we should be looking for these kinds of developmental kind of hazards and risks in these products, but that's not what we did. We actually really broadened the rule. Yeah.
Do you have any theories about why there is this constant disjuncture between policy and response?
I have some theories. I don't know if it's ever been written about or tested. And anybody have any ideas? One would be that there's an idea out there already, and this is just the chance that they have to kind of use this as a point of departure to kind of leap in and make some changes. So it may have been perceived that, we need to regulate. And the FDA, I'm sure the FDA felt, we have no control over what's really marketed. We have no idea whether things that are marketed work in the way that they're represented. And people are just putting out their stuff. We don't know, really don't know if it works. So why not hold people's feet to the fire and make them prove that it works? And this was just that moment in time that gave them the ability to do that, I would think. I don't know that. All right, so that happened. So the FFDCA amendment basically gave us the kind of current research environment that we have for clinical trials, phase one, safety studies, phase two was pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamic studies, and phase three, large clinical trials, randomized clinical and blinded clinical trials to prove efficacy, right? And basically, and that safety of drugs. So moving ahead, 1964, we had the first World Medical Association's Declaration of Helsinki. So you'll get to the declaration in 2 weeks. The declaration and the World Medical Association picked up the issue of research ethics because of because of the perception that there was no regulation, and then that the Nuremberg Code was out there, that they might have the Nuremberg Code imposed upon them, clinicians, and that good clinicians have to do research. It was felt that there was a kind of a gap here, and we need to fill it in with some guidelines on how to do human subjects research. There's been a lot of changes to the declaration since. I think we're up to 8 or 9 or 11. I forget how many. It's around a dozen, give or take, amendments that have been made. And some of them have been pretty important and substantive. And some of them have been highly contentious. In 2001 or 2002 edition, it contained provisions that the FDA could not agree to, right, legally, such as that somebody has an obligation to publish the results, that the people who are doing research in underserved populations have an obligation to use the best available, whatever that means, best available treatments as a comparator. So, does that mean that you can't use a placebo if there is an existing treatment available? Mm-hmm. FDA can get around that one, but the publication thing was pretty unassailable. So FDA actually, there was a statement, I believe, in around 2004 or so, where the FDA said no longer will we hold people to require people, applicants, to say that they're complying with the Declaration of Helsinki, because statutorily they had no authority. And there was a whole cadre of especially people in the research ethics world who were like, well, how can you say that? People should have an obligation to publish. And so they have an FDA is a statutory entity. It has a statute behind it that says what it's able to do, and it can't tell people to publish. Right? Yes, it's a nice ethical thing to do, but it can't. It has no authority to do that unless Congress gives it the authority to do that. And Congress won't do that, of course. So anyway, this declaration exists. And it's more honored outside of the country. If you actually ask investigators here or IRB people here, do they apply Helsinki? The answer is largely no. They look at the common rule, the set of rules we'll get to at the end of this year. But the declaration exists, and it's more appropriate and more kind of followed outside of the United States. Also in 1964, we had revelations about Stanley Milgram's experiments. Anybody who know who Stanley Milgram was?
So he did those shock experiments.
Yeah.
I don't know who
right.
he was exactly.
So Milgram was a social psychologist at Yale who performed a series of experiments, not really delivering shocks, but delivering fake shocks. he set up an experiment whereby one person was recruited as a human subject, and a second person was a fake human subject. The Confederate was always, they go through a drawing, the Confederate was uniformly chosen to be a learner, and the true subject was always assigned the role of teacher. And the teacher was to give word pairs to the learner, and the learner was supposedly shocked if he or she got the answers wrong. And the condition was that the shocks would increase in intensity. And the shock board, if anybody's ever seen the video, I've got the video if anybody wants to see it. It's pretty shocking, actually. It's actually really disturbing. But the idea was that you move up in shocks, and the shock board itself says, minor shock, medium shock, major shock, I think it says severe shock, and then XXX, right? And then it stops at some point, like 450 volts or something, it stops out here. Milgram, in his work up to this experiment, asked, I forget how many, I think 100 psychologists, how many subjects, or no, yes, some 20 psychologists, at how many, out of 100 subjects, how many would go all the way? and they said less than 1 in 10, I think, or less than 1 in 10. Less than 1 in 1,000 subjects. So they said 1/10 out of 1 in 100, less than 1/10 of 1 subject. So less than 1 out of 1,000 subjects would go all the way to the end. In the core condition where Milgram was sitting in one, the Milgram subject was in one room with this chalkboard and speaking to the subject in another room. He could not see him, but they were communicating by microphone and speaker. 70%, 65 to 70% went all the way. And it was extremely disturbing, and people, the subjects themselves were extremely stressed. If you watch the video, it's really disturbing to see how the experimenter could allow the subjects to be so torn apart by what it is they're doing. But nonetheless, they did it. He then modified it. In his response to criticism, he modified the protocol. He moved it off of Yale's campus, and then he moved the subject from behind the room. He moved the subject closer to the learner, closer to the teacher, which reduced compliance, of course, especially in the last condition when the teacher had to hold the learner's hand on a shot plate. Nonetheless, some people still went all the way. And then and he also moved the experimenter, the voice of authority, moved him away. So it was turned from the guy in the white coat in the room telling him that the experiment requires that you continue I think at first it was a phone call, communication by phone, to instructions by tape. So as the authority figure moved away, compliance dropped, and as the learner, the reality of this other human being punished, moved more close to the teacher, compliance also dropped. It never dropped to zero, though, which is really shocking. And there's that word again. I got to find another word for it. Anyway, he was thoroughly attacked for this. He did go back a year later, and he kind of interviewed his subjects, found that, I think 1 in 100 subjects or so had kind of some long-term sequelae from this. For the most part, people really, and then you hear this in other experiments of this sort as well, that people kind of appreciated the insights that they gained into their own weaknesses or vulnerabilities from participation. But nonetheless, the psychological stress that he placed on people was pretty extreme in this. Since this time, other people have done the experiments, have redone the experiments, and things haven't apparently improved too much. They've taken it to the point where, they stopped early. They stopped much, much earlier before kind of going, continuing down the path into the XXX range. And people still get there. All right. Another case was the Jewish Chronic Disease Hospital case, also in 64. This was a case of 22 or 23 indwelling patients at the Jewish Chronic Disease Hospital in Brooklyn. They weren't going anywhere, so they're good research subjects. One of the reasons you often want to do research on people who are in controlled environments is because you do control their environment. That's why prisoners make such great subjects. But these indwelling patients were basically approached and asked to participate in a quote skin test. This was by a researcher from what became Sloan Kettering. He was a leading cancer researcher. He was looking at whether or not cancer is communicable. So the skin test was actually injection into the thigh under the skin of a bolus of live human cancer cells. And then over the following week, they'd watch how the body launched an immune response to the attack of cells, and hopefully it defeated it. It turned out that one subject died several days, I think 2 days after the injection, from a previously undiagnosed bladder cancer. There was a public outcry about this. There was an inquiry into the case by the state medical licensing board, which sanctioned the physician who did the research, and it also sanctioned the physician who ran the Jewish Chronic Disease Hospital for letting him in. Nonetheless, in 1966, the researcher who did this was elected head of the National Cancer Research Organization. I forget what it was called back then. The public actually responded to this pretty strongly, and even the medical board responded to this in a way differently than the scientists did. The scientists actually saw no problem here, in a way. Right? They elected this guy even though this large, arguably really unforgivable ethical transgression to head their research organization. All right. 66. So the 60s was a big hot period. In 66, we had revelations about the Willowbrook hepatitis experiments. Anybody know what this is? Heard of it? Guys who took my class. Do you remember what it was?
Is it with the disabled children?
Yeah. At the Willowbrook School.
Yeah.
On Staten Island.
That's where I grew up.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I live like a block from Willowbrook.
Really? Mm-hmm. It's still there? The building's still there?
Yeah, the buildings are still there. They say it's haunted.
So Willowbrook, basically, the problem with Willowbrook was that it had about 400 or 500% overcrowding. The state was a state facility for severely mentally disabled children, and a guy named Saul Krugman at NYU created a lab there, a research environment to study hepatitis. Hepatitis was endemic in the institution, so if you came into the institution and you just went into the floors because of the overcrowding and everything, you would be exposed and you would get hepatitis. So parents were offered the opportunity to, instead, when their kids were coming into the institution, to put the kids into the research ward where they would be systematically exposed to various bodily excreta and fluids in a way to systematically expose them to hepatitis. The research apparently was successful in distinguishing between hepatitis A and hepatitis B, although other people have criticized it, saying that there were other ways, ethical ways, to do this research, and others were doing research without kind of exposing this vulnerable population to these experiments. The research is pretty well known for its coercive nature. Parents are coming in and it's like, well, you can put your kid in the general ward, which is really horrible, or you can put him in this nice research ward where it'll be systematically taken care of and everything else. And it's pretty coercive because if the parents didn't say yes, their kid would be much worse off. All right. That was also broken. There was Geraldo. So Geraldo, the revelations on Willowbrook was by Geraldo Rivera, who he was a young guy back there, and it was like, this was his breakout moment. He kind of snuck into the facility and took tapes and stuff. And I have that video. I'm not allowed to show it in class. I don't have a license to show it in class. But if anybody wants to see it, I have it. All right, 66 also. The Public Health Service altered its requirements for requiring institutional review boards and informed consent for research. So this was the first kind of regulatory change that we see. It was not precipitated. It was actually came a little bit before Henry Beecher's study was published in the New England Journal. I think this was May or June, and this was July or August. A lot of people have a tendency, because they were both 66, to think that Beecher's article precipitated the PHS to act. It's actually backwards. So there, which indicates there was something else going on. You know, there was something in the air or something in the water that was kind of like getting people to be paying attention to these issues. Anyway, Beecher published this little study where he looked at, I think, 23, a magic number of 23, studies that had been performed. And he actually called, what he did is reviewed for, I think, 3 or 5 years of leading biomedical journals. He called out a set of about 50 articles that he thought had real ethical problems in them. And he wrote the New England Journal article on 23 of those studies. It included the Jewish Chronic Disease Hospital case. It included Saul Krugman's work at Willowbrook. It included other research. Two or three studies were from Harvard. Two or three studies were from Penn and University of Rochester. All of these big research-intensive institutions were doing things without getting consent, exposing people to fairly big risks without justification. And he basically said, you know, what we need to do here is we need to pay attention to this, and we need to have ethical scientists. And his call at that time was that the scientist needs to kind of realize that, you know, that what their obligation is to protect subjects and act morally. He later reversed himself because he realized that scientists, within 5 years, he reversed himself in his book, where he said that we need some sort of prior review and some kind of way to, like with institutional review boards, for people to get peer review of their ideas and their research before they're actually implemented. Which is also interesting. I just realized that, so there's a recent paper in Science by Paul Applebaum and Robert Klitzman, where they're arguing that IRBs should not be reviewing minimal risk research before the research is done. They should basically review it after the research is done. And they should audit to try and get people to comply. And we can talk about that at some point if you wish. All right, also in 66, changing gears a little bit, was a Life magazine photo article. It was just photographs. called Concentration Camp for Dogs. And this was basically fairly disturbing. It was labs, lab animals, and a lot of the animals had come from pounds at the time. It was fairly common for pound animals to be bought by labs and to use them, which is really kind of a bad, kind of uncontrolled way to get dogs and the like. But that's what they were doing. Anyway, this was had a fairly strong public outrage response, and led Congress to pass what became known as the Animal Welfare Act. Right. 1971, there was publication of Laud Humphreys' Tea Room Trade. Laud Humphreys was a sociologist. He was also an Episcopal priest who went back for his PhD, and he studied anonymous male gay sex in public bathrooms, which is called Tea Room Trade. He took on the role of a watch queen in this environment to keep an eye out for the cops and the like, and just watch out for the environment itself. While he was doing this, he, without knowledge of the subjects, of course, he wrote down their license plate numbers, because people would drive to this public bathroom in a park. So he wrote down their license plate numbers. And a year later, he got a police officer, a friend of his, to identify from police records who the owners of those cars were from the license plates. And then he got himself named to be the local, within his city, the investigator on a cross-nation interview study of households. And he added, he disguised himself, glasses, beard, and he went to these people's homes. He threw them into the sample, and he went and interviewed those people as well as the sample that he was supposed to interview for the other study. And what did he find out? He found out that this group of men who were doing this fairly, strange behaviors were like a swath of society. 50% of them were married, 50% of them were Catholic. They were just like normal working people, like everybody else, and nonetheless they had this behavior. So his department, when he published his dissertation, he got a lot of flack. His department came under a lot of pressure, and the department was actually closed. His professor went to Harvard. So he did okay, and then there was actually calls for his PhD to be yanked. That didn't happen. He actually wound up at the Claremont Schools in California, and he spent his career there and died some 10-15 years later. All right. Also in 1972, we had revelations about the Stanford Prison Experiment. Yeah.
Can I ask you, going back to the World Medical Association Declaration, you just said U.S. didn't consider itself bound by this, right? Or it's followed more outside.
It's a guideline. So the World Medical Association has no legal authority.
But really. The American Medical Association signed on to that, right?
In what way?
That they agree to be bound by it as a group of physicians. Did they not?
I have no idea. I don't know. If you can find something, that is possible.
No, what I just... It's just wondering, as you're going through the chronology, it's like there are documents out there, and they state correct principles, and then it doesn't matter. It keeps going, like, you're just following your chronology. It's like it doesn't matter what's out there, I guess, until the common rule.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're guidelines, right? And, you know, what force and effect does a guideline really have, unless somebody comes across? I mean, it used to be that the FDA did, up until the mid-2000s, kind of say that you should say that you comply. Actually, they used to say you should comply with Nuremberg, but that's just kind of ridiculous. But complying with the FDA rules and with the Declaration of Helsinki. And if you go back to journal articles, people will often say, we complied with these rules and the Declaration of Helsinki. But Helsinki changed 10 years ago, right? And those changes are substantial. I think they conflict with U.S. law, and U.S. law. There's no obligation to change U.S. law to make it track those, because it is a kind of an ethical judgment. I mean, I think somebody would have a hard time saying, "Well, let's look at the provision on publication." Somebody would have a very hard time, I think, making an ethical argument that you shouldn't publish your science. Right? But from a legal perspective and from my regulatory perspective of the biopharmaceutical industry, I mean, it's a competitive industry. If they have to publish everything, then it's going to kind of open up the doors, and we don't think the industry doesn't want that. So it becomes totally a commercial issue about protection of proprietary data if they don't want to put it out there. they're not bound to put it out there. Of course, they're coming under other pressures. I mean, there's now, and Glaxo, I think, took the lead on kind of putting out its clinical trials. And in, on their clinical trials registry, they're actually putting up results. Right. In the old days, they wouldn't have to necessarily do that. If they did a phase one trial on a drug and it died during the clinical phase one trial, they would publish that. You want other, in fact, they would say, the pharmaceutical industry would tell you, if somebody else barks down that tree, barks up that tree, not down that tree, up the tree, and wastes resources going after a therapeutic target that, you know, or a drug target that we already know doesn't work, that's wasted money that they can't spend competing with us. It's human subjects, right?
Of course, if they did the trial here, for example, we would have the right to publish, and that would be contractually agreed to.
Maybe. And the question then is, if you have three subjects on a phase one trial, or you have two subjects on a phase one trial, what can you publish?
I mean, obviously, you wouldn't want to publish something that has no publishable sort of merit.
Mm-hmm. But especially a phase one trial. It's like a phase one trial. It may not really, especially if you don't have the full population of subjects, you don't have anything to publish.
It wouldn't be worth publishing.
Right.
The Academic Health Sciences Center is in Toronto because there was a research issue where information was being suppressed about the danger of a drug, and they decided not to publish. Now agree amongst all of them that when they do contracts, like the standard form contract, you cannot force the institutions not to publish the information. They have a chance to look at it, but they don't say the final say on it. So
but Oliveri, I mean, she had control of her study. It was her study. Mm-hmm. The problem with phase one trials sponsored by industry are oftentimes that they're disseminated. Nobody but the sponsor has enough data to really publish.
Yes, you can't deal with that.
The good thing is that the industry is coming around to grip.
Right.
So we have that
fight over, if you find out sort of adverse results about the drug, you will let us know. I mean, so we do fight about those sorts of provisions.
Mm-hmm. And they have an obligation, obviously, if they have a data and safety monitoring board. And if I'm saying anything, that's another thing, because everybody has different backgrounds here. If I say something, especially if I use an acronym that you don't know, stick your plug in, say something about it, because the only way, you have to make sure that you're on the page. So, but anyway, if they have DSMBs and the IRBs, they have reporting requirements, and AEs and SAEs, significant adverse event reports and stuff, have to be reported back to the IRBs. So the IRBs may find out about it, and they, of course, the reporting back doesn't go straight to the IRB, it goes through the investigator. And so the investigator arguably knows about those risks, but you still couldn't then publish it, right? You don't have the good enough data to publish, and you really wouldn't necessarily want to.
Right, but if one is concerned about the data getting out to the study subjects and to similar studies, that, let's put it this way, one can build in the mechanisms to make that happen.
Sure. And the industry, like I said, the industry is coming around to this. I mean, I think they recognize that it is ethical to kind of put their data out there. Right. And even if it isn't anti-competitive, it's anti-competitive. It is anti-competitive.
But there's reputational harm. There could be reputational harm if you sit on the data and it makes its way out anyway, and then at least this way you get to control it a bit.
Right. And I always argued, I mean, no IRB, for instance, I always thought if you go to an IRB and you say, I want to do a study, and by the way, if it's negative, I'm not going to publish it. they would say no. And so you don't have to put that statement in there. In the old days, that's the rules, and the IRBs don't question it. They're not savvy enough to have questioned it. And that's like, I mean, the industry should not have been allowed to get away with that, with suppression of publication. All right, so where are we? All right, Stanford Prison Experiment. Anybody ever seen the video?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a pretty good one. It's also disturbing. A lot of this stuff. So Phil Zimbardo is a psychologist at Stanford, and this was his first 15 minutes of fame, was the publication of the study. The study was supposed to last 2 weeks. He basically kind of built a mock prison at Stanford in the psychology department. He recruited in the local newspapers, he recruited subjects, young healthy males, and he randomly assigned them, after a battery of psychological tests, he randomly assigned them to be guards or prisoners. The prisoners were told to be home on a particular date, and the Palo Alto police were recruited to go pick them up book them and actually put them against the car, handcuff them in a very public way, and take them to the police department, the police station, kind of fingerprint them, and then they were picked up and taken to Stanford. I'm not sure that the IRB was there savvy enough to know that there was going to be a public arrest, because that's reputationally pretty harmful to someone. And it didn't have to happen that way, but that's what he did. It's very real, I suppose. Anyway, he basically kind of created the prison to make the prisoners think that they were prisoners, and it apparently was extremely successful. There was one point where he got people to write letters home, and they were told to sign with a name that your mother gave you, and half the prisoners used their prisoner number to sign the letter. So the prisoners and the acclimation to the environment was real and rapid, and there was a psychological breakdown on all levels. One person who really broke down very quickly after about one day and was released after a day and a half, he actually became a prison psychologist, and that's one of the really telling stories from this experiment. And again, there was psychological harm. There was a graduate student who was watching the experiment unfold. And she told him, at some point, she told Zimbardo that he had to stop the experiment. This was just inhumane. I think that was his later wife. Psychologists, especially at Stanford, have a tendency to marry the graduate students. I'm not sure why it is, but... anyway... He did go, but just like Milgram did, he went back and he kind of like stayed in touch with his subjects, and over the years they've kind of followed people. And again, I think people gained a lot of insight into their own kind of their own being from being in this kind of research. This became an issue during Abu Ghraib. Zimbardo's second 15 minutes of fame, when he was kind of giving testimony about the fact that those guards were couldn't quite be expected to do what they did. 1973, we had two big things. One was the publication in Science of Rosenhan's the psychiatric hospital case. This couldn't be done nowadays, but it was basically some fellows and I think fellows and residents in psychiatry went to see a psychiatrist and said they were hearing voices. That's all they said. They were admitted to the hospital, and as soon as they got in the hospital, they stopped saying that they were hearing voices, and they just started taking notes on how everybody was reacting to them. The staff reacted to them as if they were schizoid and like paranoid schizophrenics just off the wall, whereas the inmates, the patients, all were like, why are you in here? And so they saw right through it. The reaction to this was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. There was a public kind of like disquiet about this study, and that was in part the response. And also in 73 we had the revelations of the Tuskegee syphilis study, and was finally revealed in public. This led Congress to pass the National Research Act. The Act created the National Commission for the Protection of Human Subjects in Biomedical and Behavioral Research, which met from 1974 to 1977, I think. Also, in response here in 1974, the HHS, the Health and Human Services, passed the requirement for IRBs and informed consent, the FDA and the NIH. In 1966, the original requirement for this, requirements for IRBs and informed consent, was internal for the NIH Clinical Center. I mean, it was also FDA. So FDA's requirements for IRBs did permeate into the environment, because any place where sponsored research was taking place, like at Penn and the like, or UCSF, those places needed to have institutional review boards. So that original 66 rule, as it affected the FDA, actually kind of gave us IRBs, and IRBs started being formed all over the country. All right, so this one was a broader requirement that anybody who was doing DHHS funded research externally would need to have IRBs to inform consent. In 76, there was the Dalkin Shield case. So then there's another responsive case. The Dalkin Shield was it's a form of IUD. It had a string attached to it. The string allowed wicking of bacteria, caused pelvic inflammatory disease and sterility. Somebody woke up and realized, and the public woke up, and Congress woke up and realized that no one had any authority to kind of regulate medical devices. So this led Congress to pass the Medical Device Amendments of the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, which basically gave FDA similar but not really as comprehensive authority over devices. Meantime, the National Commission is meeting, and in 1979, I suppose it's that late, they issued the Belmont Report. So the readings for this week, you have the Belmont Report. And the Belmont Report is a very succinct 13-page thing that basically justifies how we do research on human subjects. It's very, very short and sweet. It's a very easy read. Behind it are volumes of appendices. Right? And the appendices are available if you want them. Some of them are good. The report on children, research on children, is probably still current and still germane. If anybody ever does research on children, getting that appendix, which is only this thick, it documents the commission's real thinking about doing research on children. It's a good read. Anyway, the Belmont Report issued, and one of the things the National Commission did is like, look, government is spending billions of dollars on research. We should be regulating this area. We should have guidelines and formal rules to guide behaviors. So in 1979 or early 80, I forget exactly when, the Department of Health and Human Services promulgated rules for the protection of human subjects. The rulemaking process is basically you publish draft rules, you solicit public comment, and then the agency responds to the public comments, either changing the comments, changing the rules. They can kind of iterate a couple of times if they wish, and then they issue a final rule saying when it's going to take effect. This set of rules, it was interesting on various accounts, but the rule was, during the late Carter administration, it was being kicked around, and then Ronald Reagan was elected on an anti-government, anti-big government platform. So there was a movement within the agency to get the rules signed before Reagan took office. And apparently they went to, I think it was Secretary Schlesinger at the time, it wasn't HHS, it was Hugh, and they asked if he would sign the rule. He said, have it on my desk with responses to the comments tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. and I'll sign it. So apparently that led to an all-nighter across the multiple federal agencies actually, trying to get the comments written. So they'd gotten some 50,000 comments, which isn't atypical. Although at the time it was atypical because you didn't have the internet to be able to do that. And they had to actually go through those, categorize them, and then respond to them in some substantive way. And as a result, it's a little too detailed for this, but as a result, some of the comments and stuff are not that sensible. Some make no sense at all, in fact. But they did get it done, and they got it to his desk on 9 o'clock in the morning, and he signed it. And that was what is now. I mean, it's 45 CFR Part 46, subparts A, B, C, and D. Subpart A, 1989. Subpart A was formally adopted by all federal agencies that perform or support and sponsor human subjects research, except for FDA. FDA has its own parallel set of regulations, but because all agencies signed on to Subpart A is known as the common rule. So when you hear me say the common rule, it's only referring to Subpart A. Subpart B is fetuses and pregnant women. Subpart C is prisoners, and Subpart D is children. Right? They have not been adopted by all the agencies that do the research. So therefore, they're not part of the common rule. Right? But if you're basically at an institution that's doing research, these, even if they're not adopted and maybe the CIA hasn't signed on to the children's rule, even if you're funded by the CIA, you'd be wise to kind of apply it. And essentially, the rule has become a national kind of a floor standard for doing human subjects research. Yeah.
But there's no requirement that a federal agency adopt a common rule?
No. In fact, the statutory authority, I'm not even sure about the statutory authority for the agencies to adopt this. I mean, in some sense, agencies can only act with statutory authority granted to them by Congress. And I guess under the health, I don't know this, I should know this, but I don't. But under the National Research Act, maybe HHS has the authority to do what's reasonable, and this set of rules would fit within that. but whether or not the Department of Defense and CIA and everybody else, I mean, they have some discretion, especially if they're going to be doing research, then they have some discretion to say, well, if we're going to be funding research, then we should have some ethics and guidelines for that. And they're, to the extent that they're allowed to fund the research, I'm sure that it's not beyond their power to say, you know, here's the set of rules that will apply doing that. It's a little bit problematic if they actually funded research. For instance, if EPA is funding research and they don't sign on to Subpart D, that'd be a little bit awkward, especially because the EPA has gotten into trouble over some studies involving toxic exposures of children, planned toxic exposures of children.
But this is very dangerous. That is voluntary. You go back, I'm always wanting there to be something that binds. So we've had in the past these guidelines, and now we have a robust rule, but it's voluntary whether federal agencies, subject to reputational risk, it's voluntary whether agencies choose to sign on to it. That's pretty dangerous. No?
Well, Congress, the thing is, the agencies act at Congress's will. If the agency doesn't, if the agency, if there was a problem and Congress perceived a problem, the agency could be told to do it. I don't think there's any major loopholes here. So it doesn't seem to me to be a big problem. But. All right. So that gave us the set of rules that we're going to be doing this week. So in 1981, then, the federal regulation, this federal regulation went into effect. It's been modified a couple of times since then. You have a copy in the readings, and you should read it this week. And it's dry, it's regulation language. But what those regulations do is they give us a requirement that the research that is funded by the federal government be approved by an IRB and have informed consent of subjects. That's the set of conditions, a set of controls that we've imposed, pretty much. And that is the, if you think about it worldwide, that is the two things that we do worldwide to ensure that human subjects research is done by at least by some set of standards. Beyond that, there's a lot of wiggle room, right? You know, a lot of kind of loopholes, there's exemptions, there's different levels of review. So when you read the rule this week, you know, think about where the loopholes are, and I'll talk about those loopholes next week. Since 1981, there's been various things that have happened as well. I'll just talk about a couple of them. In 1985, there was the revelations about the Penn head trauma. So this was a guy named Generelli at Penn, who was a, I don't think he's an MD, but he was doing basically smacking monkeys in the head with a very, very hard, creating brain injuries in monkeys. And as well as the Edward Taub case, Edward Taub was cutting the nerves in monkeys to basically watch how nerves kind of like regenerate, but how the animals could regain control and functionality by other nerves picking up the gas. Well, anyway. In the Penn head trauma case, it was here, obviously, there was a break-in by PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, on, I believe, Memorial Day in 1985. Apparently, it was an inside job because no locks were broken. They stole 60 hours of tapes that were kept around for record recording purposes, from which they culled 25 minutes of animals being smacked and kind of like gross, unsanitary surgical practices, kind of like not very good research practices, and some gallows humor by the research staff. This was basically sent to Congress and is shown in Congress. The Edward Taub case, the PETA people got the police to raid Edward Taub. He was a University of Maryland researcher. They raid his facility and take the animals under the state Animal Cruelty Act. They took the animals. PETA wound up taking control of the animals. The animals didn't really turn out all that well because PETA really didn't have the facilities or the know-how to take care of these animals. Anyway, this all went to Congress. Congress amended the Animal Welfare Act. And then this amendment gave us what are called IACUCs, Institutional Animal Care and Use Committees. And actually, the controls of IACUCs are so much greater than anything that we do with humans. And in some ways, you can't get consent from animals. So therefore, every animal you use, you have to do power calculations. You have to justify the use of every single animal you're going to use. There's no surplusage of animals. And then there's reporting as well. We know how many animals of each category are used in this country, except for rice and rats, mice and rats. Right, rats. Did I say that right? Rats and mice. Sorry. Anyway, and there's a story behind that as well. But anyway. Anyway, so since then we've had very tight controls on animal research. Let's see. Other things happened. There was, you know, just because we have these rules in place doesn't prohibit things from happening. There was an interesting study that was published in the Journal of Reconstructive Surgery in 1994. And it was done by researchers. It was done by clinicians, really. I won't honor them by calling them researchers. But it was some plastic surgeons at Manhattan Ear and Eye, Ryan Ear, where they wanted to know of two different facelift techniques, which one worked better. So they had a series of 13 patients who, without their patient's knowledge, one surgeon used one technique on one side of the face, and another surgeon used another technique on the other side of the face. And they published it in the journal. And the journal took it. Right? Of course, they didn't have IRB approval. One of the patients apparently realized that they were one of these subjects. They reported it to the OPRR, the NIH Office of Protection for Research Risks. And OPRR opened an inquiry into the case and realized that it wasn't federally funded, that this organization, the hospital, did not have what's called an MPA, or at the time was a multiple project assurance with the government saying they would comply with the rules. Therefore, OPRR had no jurisdiction. The other thing about this case is that because it involves plastic surgery, you're not going to get anybody to sue. There are two topics that are extremely, extremely, well, three topics that are extremely, extremely private, if you think about it, and next to never result in litigation, no matter what harms are done. One is abortion. One is plastic surgery. I mean, you hear all kinds of things about plastic surgery, and the other is IVF. IVF, the secrecy that goes on in IVF is crazy. So people are not going to sue because then it becomes a public record. So anyway, there was no suit in this case, despite what had happened to these people. And the doctor's justification, apparently, in part, was, well, if it came out differently, then we could just redo it, redo the surgery with the other technique. And of course, anybody knows plastic surgery. It's like, in faces, right? Faces are so different. How would you ever know? How'd they ever get that published, even? So just because we have the rules doesn't mean there aren't big loopholes to it. In the late 1990s, the Office for Protection from Research Risks, a guy named Gary Ellis, who was the head of it, did two things that were really kind of a little bit weird. One was that he shut down a number of institutions. We were kind of joking about Virginia Commonwealth a little while ago, and VCI was one of DCU. DCU was one of the institutions, and I think the last institution that got shut down. University of Illinois at Chicago, Duke, notoriously, got shut down. Duke was shut down for 3 days. Basically, all the funding stopped for all of their studies, which was a lot of money. And Duke responded. The reason Duke got shut down is because they had one institutional review board that would basically meet one time a month. They had probably about 2,000 protocols open at the institution. They'd meet once, they'd meet at noon, they'd have lunch, they'd keep on working until they finished, which would be post-dinner sometime. And I always wanted to say, well, how much time did they say? I'd like to see the minutes for the 8 o'clock meeting versus the 1 o'clock. But anyway, they didn't need to. OHRP, kind of OPRR stepped in and kind of like crunched them. They responded very quickly. They published, in fact, Ed Holmes, who was the chair of medicine at the time, or the dean there, published an article in Science, I believe, saying, we spent, this is how we responded, we spent $1 million to kind of throw it at it, now we have four or five IRBs, and the IRB system is much better. Penn did much the same thing in response to Gelsinger. At the time of Gelsinger, I was on IRB 4. In fact, when I came to Penn in 95, I think we were in 96 or so, I joined the new IRB, IRB 4. We now have 8, is that right? Mm-hmm. We have now 8 IRBs. The IRBs have changed a lot since then. I mean, then it was every IRB was kind of like, there's just 4 IRBs. We saw whatever came to us. Now there's an IRB that's focused on social science research, and then there are higher risk boards that deal with cancer and gene therapies and like, and then there's other just general medical boards. And other IRBs are moving in the same way. They've gotten bigger and bigger. Anyway, so that's pretty much in response to those shutdowns. So. So there's been other cases that have only come to light after long periods of time. It's actually interesting because sometimes you wonder whether or not there will be a response to these. For instance, one was I mentioned earlier was MKUltra. This was a covert CIA mind control studies, kind of going into a bar and slipping people acid. to see if it, what it did. There were inquiries. The Church Commission in the 70s, which was a church committee in Congress in the 70s, tried to collect data from the CIA on their studies. And the CIA, amazingly, for some reason, couldn't find anything. It turned out that all the records from MKUltra had been destroyed, except for a couple of snippets. There are a couple of records that have survived. And they did. They even gave LSD and other stuff to people without their knowledge. They admitted it. Later, we also found out about the U.S. government human radiation studies. This is, again, the post-war period. Radiation, you know, we were trying to figure out what human exposure to radiation does. There were studies that, you know, basically kind of dosing people up with very high doses of plutonium and other really nasty things, often with really sick patients. Again, this is in the 50s. And doctors would often justify it and say, I don't need to get consent and I don't need oversight. I'm based on the idea that these are my patients, I know what's best for my patients. And then sometimes this is extremely vulnerable, dying people. And without their knowledge, you're just kind of like doing crazy stuff to them. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, and most recently, we had revelations about the 46 to 48 Guatemala syphilis study, which, not surprisingly, was done by one of the same clowns who did the Tuskegee syphilis study and justified it to his death. But anyway, here they were basically working with prisoners. They would infect. They were getting prisoners infected by prostitutes. And they were, and the good thing, and one of the differences between this and the Tuskegee study is that they were treating people. Whether or not they were treating everyone is an open, I don't think they were capable of treating, like going off and getting, reaching the prostitutes that they were paying to have sex with the prisoners. But the prisoners and the people they purposefully infected were being treated. The one big distinction. All right. So I'm gonna stop there. Because next week we're going to talk about the Belmont Report and IRBs and the like and the goals. So. Oh. that was the driest talk I ever give, I promise. So, any questions about this? It's very US based and there have been studies. You know, it's always an open question, but it's what was going on in the South. What was going on in the Global South? Especially during colonial medicine, you know, what we were doing down south. And it's never really clear. I had some research, some students and stuff go digging. I've tried to dig into it. And it's hard to find. I mean, there's clearly abuses and there's power, and like, but I haven't found any real good instances of research and research abuses from the past, in like the 1800s and all.
To the extent medically certified, like doctors, nurses, whoever were involved in any of these, were there ramifications, stripping of licenses and such?
Not here. Yeah. In England, there have been several cases, especially recently, where physicians have failed to get consent, failed to get research ethics boards. So in the rest of the world, except for the US, IRBs are called REBs, research ethics boards. So we're institutional review boards versus research ethics boards. And anyway, in Europe, in England, I only know of three cases where physicians have been struck from the rolls for violation of research ethics rules. Here, I don't know of any cases like that. Yeah?
I was just wondering if that's been systematically looked at, though, since we have this, it's really state-regulated physician licensure and now federal regulation of research practice. We would know if there were federal sanctions, but it would be a much more difficult thing to track back through whether there had been any consequent state medical board.
Yeah, I mean, with the one case, so even the one case where, there was a sanction imposed upon the researcher and the head of the Jewish Chronic Disease Hospital, and that was 66. And 64, they both walked away. They're both able to continue practicing medicine. Part of the problem is maybe is that the licensing boards, maybe it's not even malpractice. It's not even clear that somebody would be reported to the PD, what is it, the physician, NPDB, National Practitioner Data Bank, which is a national collection of malpractice records. So if you're a physician and you're sued successfully, it gets reported to the feds. And that's searchable by state medical licensure boards. And I think it's discoverable by insurers, I think. Right? Anybody know? Doc's here. Anyway, but I don't know that this kind of thing would even make it that far. And Jim Wilson is a physician, right? And he was sanctioned, but his sanction was limited to doing FDA licensed studies. So he's still a physician. I'm sure there was a state licensing action taken against him. Sometimes there's lawsuits. I mean, the Gelsinger case is a good example of that. There was a lawsuit, but that's civil. And that's, you know, are they going to go after the person's license as well? I don't know. Maybe in a really egregious case, it would be an interesting precedent-setting thing to kind of go after somebody's license. But, I mean, is it the practice of medicine? Arguably not. Right? And it depends what they did, obviously.
Maybe you could make it reportable that a research misconduct or whatever, that the nomenclature would have to be reported to the state licensing board.
Yeah.
By whomever found the research misconduct.
Right. Well, listen, and at the end of the day, I mean, misconduct of both of the human subjects regulations and misconduct, like scientific misconduct, are really, really pretty rare. I mean, they're rare to be discovered. Right? For the most part, people play by the rules. Now, there are exceptions. I mean, who's the guy that used to be a Penn, the cardiac guy, is now at Chester? He developed, what's his name? Oh. He's got stuff named after him. Anybody know this guy? What's his name? I'm blanking on his name. Big cardiac guy. And he was using outdated consent forms and protocols. He was doing stuff that he just wanted to do. He was so arrogant. He just wanted to do what he wanted to do. He wasn't going to let anybody get in his way. And he got called on it. And I'm not sure that he was, you know, not particularly. I don't think he would lost his license or anything like that over it. The one Canadian guy was Roger Poisson. Roger Poisson was on the large multi-center study of mastectomy versus lumpectomy in breast cancer. And he enrolled 109 women who did not meet entry criteria. And his sanction was by the feds. He was debarred from federal funding or sitting on advisory boards or the like for 10 years. He actually retired, but I don't know if the institution, he was at a hospital in Montreal, he retired, he was old, and I don't know if the institution forced him out at that point or not. But
you certainly could, because I mean, you can say in Ontario, conduct unbecoming a physician, I mean, there's all sorts of ways one could go after them, which are, it's a more robust regulatory system over physicians, sure. But...
And there's been cases, for instance, I mean, there's been cases where researchers have gone to jail, but that's not human subjects for the most part. There is one human subject, it wasn't human subjects, actually. So a guy named Bezwota was in South Africa, and some 15 years ago, he came to a big national U.S. cancer clinical cancer meeting, and he reported results of a trial of high-dose chemotherapy and autologous bone marrow transplant in metastatic cancer patients, showing that there was a survival benefit. And there were three huge trials that had been done here in the United States showing no such benefit. So the NCI dutifully dispatched a number of researchers from the U.S. down to South Africa to look at his data. And what they found was goose egg. He'd manufactured it at all. He actually went to jail. And the interesting thing is, what happens then? I mean, it's not a good thing for a doctor to be in jail. So once you have that criminal record, maybe that is becoming unbecoming, physician, and
well,
they could be sanctioned.
Report. So currently, now you have to report any offenses. You really have to, now doctors in Ontario have to report any offenses they're convicted of, and it goes on the public website.
Speeding
so
again,
that you know who you're going to, but you want to know who you're going to.
Sure.
I was wondering about the Operation Paperclip that was used for some of the Nazi doctors. Is that? Well, I was just thinking about how some of the rules and regulations are created very incident specific. Mm-hmm. It seems like there's some sort of salvaging of the expertise of scientists and physicians, whatever can be salvaged and still continue to be used. Mm-hmm. Is where it coming from? That.
Sure.
Same sort of decision.
So this is paperclip was to bring the doctors here?
Right. Well, yeah. They were supposed to be prosecuted, but instead they paperclipped their documents so that they could actually use their information that they were bringing back.
Well, the spoils of war, the victor collects the spoils of war. We also, I mean, we took rocket scientists and brought them here. Right? We we didn't prosecute the Japanese who were kind of doing really nasty things in China, so even to U.S. troops.
I just wonder if that's the purpose of some of these incidences. Mm-hmm. Regulations is not to disparage all of the expertise that it can be somehow established.
Possibly. I mean, that's gets us to the kind of the policies about sanctions.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I did a study some years ago looking at whether or not, you know, do we throw the book? Because there's always this story within science that when somebody commits misconduct, which is falsification, fabrication, or plagiarism, we throw the book at them and they're out of the field. You know, you're just kind of violated all of the norms of science. Bang, bye-bye, you can't be a scientist anymore. Turns out that everybody retains, for the most part, everybody retains a scientific career, some in academia, a good number in academia, and you know, some, they leave, they go to industry, which is a good thing, because if they didn't make it in the academy, where we trust people to do the right thing and to be honest, at least in industry, you've got somebody looking over your shoulder. So maybe they belong there.
Wasn't Wakefield was, his license was taken away too.
What did he do?
He was the autism.
Yeah, but he works in port.
Yeah, he does, yeah. But not as a physician. I think just as a.
He's the one who did the studies linking
vaccinations to autism.
Oh, that's that guy. Right.
Yeah.
He's British or something, right? Is it the British?
British.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's in Florida?
Yeah.
He's, yeah. So why? Like, why in that instance would you imagine that Florida wouldn't point?
I don't know. He has a big name. He has a big following. So mm-hmm. families who are, you know, despite there being no evidence to support this link, there are families who all the time swear that they don't want their child vaccinated and there's alternative therapy movements. But he's like their guru.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. He's important.
But in the UK, I think they pulled his license and they threw him out of the academy and they looked through his papers and that sort of thing.
Yeah. I mean, in the UK, they take it more seriously. I mean, I don't know of cases here where they've done that. Okay. Sorry?
No, I'm sorry. I guess it was a throwaway comment, but it's a bit of a buyer's beware. Everyone does know about him, and there are very different camps of thought about this issue. So, now the other question is whether he's actually licensed to practice anything.
This was so publicly. I don't think so, but I think he's practicing, not medicine. He still has holistic something.
He runs an internet-based organization.
Yeah. It's one of the anti-vaccine communities.
There's a lot of money in that. Well, good. That's all. The class usually goes to about 7. No, but tonight I have a zoning board thing tonight at 7, so I'm active.
Sorry, it's from 4:30 to 7 or 4:30?
It's 4:30 to, it's actually technically from 4:30 to 7:10, but there's like a train at like 7:08, so people usually get up and so we try to wrap up. We can take a break. Yeah, we can. I mean, we're very flexible. So it's nice meeting y'all. I look forward to it.